This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, Irirangi Tumotu, MPR.
Kia ora and welcome to Reserved Recommendations. This is a show about great trash, difficult art, and our complicated relationships with art and culture. My name's Hugh, I'm the host of the show, and I'd like to take this opportunity to put in a very mild content warning for the show as a whole. Sometimes our recommendations on this show are reserved just because the thing that we're discussing is in some way not good, but sometimes there are aspects of the art or artist that may be confronting for some people. Check the episode descriptions for more information, and do be aware of your listening environment. That's right, so you're listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast about great trash and difficult art. We are definitely in great trash town tonight. Just quickly to mention that this radio show and podcast is, of course, produced under the auspices of Manawatu People's Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatu, with the support of New Zealand On Air, so cheers for that, guys. Today I am joined by Asher Albine. Did I pronounce your name correctly? I normally check surnames before I start, but Asher, welcome and thank you for recommending me a work of cinema. We are talking about The Howling 3, and it is a thing.
It is a truly transcendental piece of filmed entertainment, I guess you have to call it.
Yeah. So, like, you mentioned it on Blue Sky, and I was struck by the description of a scene where a young woman is, like, she's hit by a car, and then in the hospital they discover that she is pregnant, but also a marsupial, because this is the hook of this particular movie. And I realized that there were these, like, playground discussions at my primary school in kind of whispered tones about, do you know there's this movie where this girl, like, has sex and then she's got a pouch like a kangaroo? And I mentioned that to my wife, and she said, I swear I saw that movie as a kid when I was far too young. And so, of course, I had to go and experience the actuality of this movie. And because my wife is my wife, we also watched The Howling and The Howling 2, which they're interesting for context, but really this is the one that you probably need to see to understand. How did you encounter this movie?
You know, it's funny. I did not see this as a kid. No one was ever talking about it as a kid. There were no playground rumors or myths for me. I just randomly came across a mention of it on the internet one day many years ago. That was just like, oh, you know, The Howling. I knew about The Howling as, like, ah, yes, the sort of, like, I was going to say the horny werewolf movie, but there is something.
No, I mean, it is like the innovation of The Howling as a franchise is, what if werewolves not just bloodlust, also horny?
Yeah, it really, I think that that first Howling, the sort of the book it's based on, and then Joe Dante's film adaptation, which to this day I still have not seen, but by all accounts is the actual best film of them. So I probably should watch it at some point if I want to watch a good film. But it really is the thing that takes the sort of, I think, subtext of the sort of, like, animalistic nature of the werewolf, and it's like, but what if they fucked? And, you know, that's something that obviously is now, like, really part and parcel of cinematic werewolf and to some degree, like, pop culture werewolves. But I do think The Howling is the one that sort of, like, brought that to the fore.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's a part that I remember being a notable side detail in the first American Werewolf. That's an American Werewolf in London.
Yes.
The first American Werewolf, one of the things that happens to the protagonist as he is becoming a werewolf is that he suddenly gets really good at sex. And it's just like a passing detail, but I thought it was like an interesting thing in passing. And then, as you say, like, The Howling kind of makes that, not the whole deal with werewolves, but, like, a much bigger part of the deal with werewolves.
Yeah, and which makes it so interesting, by the way, that The Howling 3 is – there's definitely sexuality in it, but it's not really a horny film in a way that is fascinating in comparison to some of the others. But to answer your original question, like, I saw references to this, and I saw references to, oh, there's a scene where a young lady gives birth, and then the Joey crawls to her pouch, and I was like, that sounds like something to see. And then I probably didn't think about it again for like 4 or 5 years. And then truly just on a wild hair, I have some friends that I have a sort of like semi-weekly, like roughly monthly movie night with. And I was just like, I'm going to roll the dice. Like, we're going to watch The Howling 2, because that's got Christopher Lee in it. And it seems quite bad, but in a fun way. And it is really bad in a very fun way. It's a completely deranged film, but not one I can really in any good conscience recommend.
No, the innovation of The Howling 2, aside from Christopher Lee, who is in a different, better movie the whole time.
Like, oh, yeah.
He is – if you just cut The Howling 2 down to the Christopher Lee bits, you would have a weird movie, definitely, but like a better movie. But it interprets the horniness of the werewolves as them just kind of going in each other's faces for like extended periods, which is –
there is a werewolf threesome, which and some of the most singularly – that is a film that I think is trying to be erotic but has a very – you never want to assume that nothing's going to float anyone's boat. But I would say that I watched it and found it to be shockingly unerotic, considering how many naked people were just sort of like standing around in a room having, I guess, technically an orgy. It was although if you're going to watch anything of The Howling, you should watch the closing credits, which are one of the most incredible bits of outsider art I think I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It is some truly astounding editing. Again, you could just watch the end credits for The Howling 2 without watching the rest of the movie, and you would get what we're talking about. If you just go and find that by itself, it's
on YouTube. It's very easy to find.
It's astonishing. But to turn to The Howling 3, so you kind of roll the dice on it, and then you discover this fascinating and transcendent piece of art. And the thing that I'm amazed by in it is that I was expecting it to be weird and deranged and kind of not good. I wasn't expecting it to have stuff on its mind.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting film because, to be clear, it is weird and deranged and kind of not good. But it is a film that is weird and deranged while also really trying to bite off way more than it can chew. And just for those who are not familiar with what The Howling 3 is, sort of like the very basic plot synopsis is that, in this world where there are secret werewolves, but, you know, anything that has happened in the other Howling movies does not matter and does not, impact the plot of this at all. There are a group of secret werewolves that are actually wear thylacines, hence Howling 3, the marsupials. They're, thylacines are sort of for those, I assume everyone probably listening to this knows what thylacines are, but if you somehow don't, they are medium sized, predatory marsupials that look kind of vaguely like wolves if you've never seen a wolf before.
Yeah, they've got really weirdly enormous jaws.
Big gape. Mm. But also oddly graceful and sort of like cute. It's a little hard. They're like they really don't look like dogs at all. Like, you can see how if you were trying to describe them to somebody, you would call them like a Tasmanian wolf, but they don't look like dogs. But the conceit is that, these Australian werewolves are not werewolves, they wear thylacines, which means that they have pouches, when they transform, they don't fully transform into thylacines for reasons I think of that being far beyond the movie's budget. And also, the movie has a very loose idea of what a werethylacine might even look like. But there are actual werewolves in this movie as well. There's a character who is a sort of a Russian ballet dancer who is a straight up a werewolf. So there is this very weird, there's this sort of like, it sets up this very weird kind of like almost urban fantasy style setting, maybe the most urban fantasy style setting that I've seen outside of something like Underworld, and maybe in some ways even more along those lines than some of those like foundational films. And the sort of the actual plot is that this young woman from this sort of tribe slash compound of werethylacines runs away from her stepfather to try and make it in the big city, falls in love with a nice young human man, and then shenanigans ensue while an American professor is trying to discover whether or not these things are what he thinks they are. And it sort of spins off in like very weird directions in terms of, you know, there are people hunting the thylacines and the thylacines are sort of hunting each other. And it just, it ends up being a very strange mixture of like it's just the plot keeps taking turns that you wouldn't expect, and they're not twists. It's not that they're twists. It's just that suddenly you'll be with three werethylacines who are dressed like nuns trying to bring the young lady back, and you'll just check in with them occasionally, and they sure are fucking werethylacines who are dressed like nuns.
One of the things that is very strange about it is that it can't seem to settle on a tone. Like, some of the time it is doing a series of jokes about the previous Howling movies. Like, one of the things that happens early on is that the young woman whose name is Jerboa, which I think is a different animal, and we'll get to that
totally
in a second.
Totally different animal, yeah.
But the sort of male protagonist love interest takes her to see a werewolf movie, which is a deliberately really bad version of the transformation sequences from the first Howling movie in particular. And she sits there in the audience going, well, that's not what it's like. But like, it is quite specifically riffing on its previous installments. Some of the time, it does seem like it wants you to take the like the connection of werewolves to nature seriously as like a thing that you should be like concerned about. There's an ecological message here. And sometimes it's like, here's a trio of werewolf nuns who are a sort of like comic chorus who just sit on the sidelines in various levels of monster
literally eating popcorn while watching something on television in a cave at one moment. But there is something like, and I think I realized that this was going to be something special, honestly, from the very beginning, because it starts with this very strange and kind of dreamlike montage of actual sort of like film footage, some of the last film footage we have of thylacines, and then footage of a sort of some sort of like strange reconstructed and not a real one indigenous rite, and this very strange sort of like folk horror vibe that the film then mostly drops but does occasionally come back around to. And the central idea of the sort of where thylacines being sort of like hunted almost to extinction, very much like, you know, what happened to the actual thylacines, gives the whole film like a strange and kind of powerful weight that makes the business about, oh, you know, in their love and lust, you know, the nice young werethylacine girl who's played, I have to say, really incredible performance by Imogen Annesley, incredible line readings, great physical performance. You know, the scene where she sort of like shacks up with this nice young himbo of a man, and then, you know, has a little strangely adorable werethylacine Joey, who, when she gives birth, crawls up to her pouch in a truly incredible piece, like incredible scene. But also there is something about this sense of like a connection to the land, a connection to survival in the face of extinction that, you know, you can't really quite get with a normal werewolf film, because there are still wolves around. They're often endangered. They're often persecuted. But there isn't that feeling of, oh, if we like really fuck around, we could lose these. We could lose this entire group of living things. And when they're gone, they're gone. And so there's something that I found really, you know, it is certainly the film reaching for an ecological parable that I don't think it can quite bring off. And yet, it does lend a gravitas to it that I was not expecting. And it's there early. It isn't always there, but it keeps sort of popping up throughout the film.
Absolutely. Like the stepfather, whose name is Thilo, short for Thylacine, has this speech about halfway through, because they ask the academic manages to like capture him and hook him up to all of these machines. And they ask him where he came from. And he has this speech about essentially like the spirit Thylacine, you know, the platonic ideal of all of the Thylacines. Once they no longer existed as animals in the world, they came into humanity, and that's why there are were Thylacines. And so there's sort of an implication that maybe Jerboa is were Jerboa in the same way that he's were Thylacine. And the Russian ballerina werewolf lady specifically says that she's come to mate with him as part of like – it's almost like a deliberate selective breeding program, although it's more kind of like visceral
mystical,
and mystical than that. But like she's come to connect with him in order to try and spread the Thylacine werewolf magic DNA.
And I think what's really fascinating about it is, you know, I've seen and read a fair amount of werewolf stories that kind of play again with this idea of like, you know, famously Twilight kind of tries to do this like, you know, the like shapeshifters, like people who are wolves and wolves who are people, and drawing this like indigenous, this sort of indigenous connection. But what I think this film actually does in a really interesting way is it takes the kind of spirit logic, I think, of actual Aboriginal mythology of people and sort of like sort of Aboriginal and indigenous folkways of like, you know, there was a time when animals became people. And this film, that is as good an explanation as you're going to get as any. It is not going to try and go, oh, well, you know, maybe they're spirits, but maybe they're biological too. Like the academic kind of vaguely suggests that, but like that is not something that works according to the logic of the film, which is there are sort of like mystical things that happen. There are sort of mystical invocations, and you know, there's a character who sort of sacrifices his own life essence to sort of invoke or bring back around this sort of larger were Thylacine spirit. It really is a film that is. It runs on folktale logic in a way that I think is really interesting and really kind of unusual for, even though you would think, oh, you know, werewolves, like a lot of werewolves movies run on folktale logic, but they don't. They run on Hollywood folklore logic, which is something different, which is a lot more knowable. And this film does not make a lick of sense and is much more compelling for it because it doesn't make sense in a way that is suggestive as opposed to being just completely incoherent.
So I have two thoughts on the basis of this, and the first is how tabletop role playing are you? Are you connected with the world of darkness at all?
I'm vaguely familiar with it because I got pulled into a vampire LARP when I was much younger, and enjoyed it, but it was just one session. So I am aware that there's a whole world here, but it's not something I'm super familiar
with. The reason I ask is that I've just been rereading the modern remake of the World of Darkness game Werewolf because I'm considering running it with my teenage kid, and they pull the quote. There's a line in the first Howling movie about like the beast and man, essentially that kind of idea, but the previous incarnation of Werewolf, the original version of Werewolf, one of the things that it eventually did is it lent into this idea that, firstly, the conceit is that werewolves are the guardians of Gaia, the earth spirit. So the job that werewolves were historically supposed to do, that they have failed at, and that's why the game is happening, is that they are supposed to protect Gaia in a mystical sense from horrible demonic incursions of various kinds. but they are cursed.
Hounds of God.
Yeah, yeah. But they are cursed with rage and with pride. And that's why there are all these stories about werewolves flipping out and killing people. Because to be a werewolf is to be like, you have this power of righteous anger, but it can also just cause you to get too mad and flip out and kill everyone who's next to you. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that they did as they developed the first incarnation of werewolf through the 1990s is they add in all these other were creatures that have different roles within the sort of cosmology that they were coming up with. So there's like were bears who were Mother Gaia's healers, and were ravens mm-hmm. who are like the finders of secrets for Mother Gaia, and were cats who are the keepers of Mother Gaia's secrets, all of these different things. But they call out the Howling One specifically by quoting from it. But actually looking at the cosmology that they put together of all of these different kinds of were spirits, it became clear to me that like they had also watched The Howling 3. They just didn't want to admit it because it's not as reputable.
Yeah. Well, what's so interesting, though, is The Howling 3 does not do the other thing you might expect, which is, you know, what the World of Darkness werewolf, what you're sort of describing to me, which is, you know, setting up its sort of, I should say, quasi-indigenous characters, although there is one character in The Howling 3 who is straight up an Aboriginal
guy. We will get to that. Yeah.
That dude rocks. But it doesn't set... They're not secretly guardians of the land. They are just people who exist somewhat in a more mythical framework than other people in the movie recognize themselves to exist in. Which I really like, because again, it gives you that sense of like, oh, these are just other people, with their own foibles and their own strangeness. And, you know, the thing about, you know, Thilo, who's played also an incredible performance by Max Fairchild, who's played as being quite threatening, but also kind of strangely childlike, and who is initially framed as being a sexual threat to Cherboa, which is why she runs away, leading to the immortal line when she's talking to a priest who is like, you shouldn't be out, you know, on the street. And she's like, well, I have to be. And she's like, well, why? She's just immaculate deadpan. My stepfather tried to rape me and he's a werewolf. but Thilo ends up being like a very interesting character because you get the sense that he's like a person, but he's not like a person. Like he exists according to a mythic logic that does not interact well with other people. And that means that, you know, in the moment when he does sort of have what I guess you could call a heroic sacrifice, it doesn't code as redemptive exactly. It just codes as this guy who's this sort of like mythical figure who has always been existing at like a slightly higher remove and was always going to end this way because this is how the story goes. So there is this like strangely like mythological component to, and it's not that people are invoking fate and destiny at all. It's just that the movie plays out according to that logic and does not really tip its hand about it, which feels, I have to say, somewhat intentional.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's one of these, like, I having now seen this movie, I would kill for a making of documentary or something.
Yeah.
Like I would love to know what they set out to do and how they ended up where they ended up, because it feels to me like there's a tension between a sort of like quite a trashy concept of like let's Crocodile Dundee werewolves, like let's get werewolves and instead put in a bunch of jokes about America's understanding of what Australia is like.
Mm-hmm.
But also, like you say, there is this kind of this mythic logic that runs throughout, and the movie can never quite seem to make up its mind which of those things it's trying to do.
Yeah, and it gives the whole a very dreamlike air, I think, which is you're never quite sure what it is that you're watching. And I think there's a probably a better movie in here that does settle on a tone, but I have to be completely honest with you. I kind of like the complete tonal mishmash of it because, again, it reminds me a little bit of if you read, it feels a little bit like reading a collection of indigenous folktales that is simultaneously, some of them are going to be pretty straight ahead and pretty like, you know, this is how this phenomenon works, and some of it is, oh, you know, the hero tales of like these people and what they did. And some of it is just gonna be dick jokes. Like it's just gonna be like, oh, coyote like fucked the beaver, and that's why coyote's dick is weird. And those three things bundled together is what this movie is.
Yes, I think that's an excellent comparison, and that leads into a discussion I'm really interested in having as well. We are around about at the halfway break, so we're going to take a quick break for station messages, and we will be back right after this.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. NPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out npr.nz for more information.
You are listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast produced by Manawatu People's Radio with the support of New Zealand On Air. I am talking to Asher Albin about the movie The Howling 3. And you were talking just before we took a break about like folktale logic, about how if you look at like collections of indigenous folktales, they often have like wildly divergent tones because, you know, some of them are for kids and some of them are for adults, and some of them are, if you like, just so stories about like, here's why this thing is this way. And some of them are kind of dirty jokes about the mythical characters. And all of these things exist in the corpus of the storytelling all at once. And so if you read them as like a collection of stories, that feels very weird. Well, not weird, but it has its own rhythm and logic, which is different to like reading a collection of Robin Hood stories that are written for kids, or a collection of stories that were actually written by a single author for kids, for example. And one of the things that I really want to talk about with this movie is it has a really weird relationship to indigeneity. There is one Aboriginal no, there are two Aboriginal characters in this film.
Yeah, there's two of them.
There is an Aboriginal guide who shows up not for very long enough to basically tell a bunch of white characters, if you persist in doing this, you are going to get killed really badly. I'm off. And then he is correct about everything. And there is another Aboriginal character who has a more kind of significant role in the movie. But the way that it handles the indigenous question mark, the Australian werewolves and their culture, it very much positions them as some kind of indigenous population somehow, but they're all white, and that's really weird.
It's very strange. Yeah, and it also it really I'm sorry, thinking about this makes me laugh so hard because the character in question, whose name is escaping me at the moment, but the sort of the Werth Eilseem, who's the indigenous man and is sort of exists kind of as like a spiritual center of the film, except that also the film, like he, like the film gives his character these moments where people are like, oh, is that like a, like an indigenous thing? He's like, no, that's me. I'm saying this, which leads to truly the most incredible line reading I've ever seen in any film. And one I think about at least like once a week, which is when he's sort of like shuffling off this mortal coil in the film. The Jerboa says, oh, you're going to become one with the mountains and the forests and the rivers and the trees. And he looks at her with just the most gimlet expression, says, no, I'm just going to die. And then he does. It's incredible. It's incredible. I'm not doing it justice. It is, we were fucking howling watching this. And it's a great joke because it's immaculately set up to be, that is what you expect this character to be. And he's not, like, he kind of is that, but he also kind of isn't. And so you end up with this thing where it's like the sort of the characters who are sort of kind of indigenous but aren't, because they're white, they're all played by white actors, except that they're not all white. So it's like, what's going, like, how are these people indigenous thylacines, except that they have the indigenous spirit of the thylacine in them, I suppose. And I don't know if this is just a failure of casting or a failure of imagination or what it is, but it lends the whole thing a very strange tension, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Because there's also the movie posits a historical relationship between Burnham indigenous.
Burnham Burnham is the name of the actor, and the character's name is Kendi. I just
right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's absolutely. But the movie also suggests a historical relationship between Aboriginal people and lycanthropes, because mm-hmm. the staged footage at the start is of a group of Aboriginal people, I think, like ritually executing a werewolf. Mm-hmm. Like they've tied a werewolf to a tree. I suppose note that werewolves in The Howling pretty much exclusively across all of the movies, they never actually turn into wolves. They turn into like giant wolf person hybrids.
Lycanthropes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's the kind of werewolf we're dealing with, as opposed to like Twilight where they turn into big wolves. But they've tied one of those transformed people to a tree and are like repeatedly spearing them until they die. So the movie's suggestion is that lycanthropy is a thing that Aboriginal people have known about and have a hostile relationship with? Or a tense relationship with, at least. It's mm-hmm. also not clear if Kendi is one of the thylacine people or if he just knows how to invoke the spirit that makes him transform as if he was.
Yeah, that's true. We do not get a lot of clarity about like he's like around, like he knows what's up. But again, it's like it's one of these things about the film where there's a lot about it that is left intentionally or not, it's very ambiguous, like what a lot of these people's deal is. And honestly, you know, at a time, I think, where a lot of fiction really wants to over-explain and sort of give you the power levels and map out the society. And I like that stuff, to be clear. I love a consistent bit of world building, but I also like something that works according to, I don't know, what do you think? And that is this film.
Yeah, absolutely. A few episodes ago, I talked about the movie Nightbreed, and one of the things that I came away from Nightbreed with is, like, with Nightbreed, you absolutely could make a long-running TV series out of it where you get to find out what each kind of Nightbreed's deal is, because it's like it's clear that in that movie that the movie is sorting them into different kinds who have different powers and do different stuff. It's just you never find out what that is. So you just have like this onslaught of weird guys who can do crazy stuff. And the crazy stuff they can do is sometimes related to the way they look, but not always. And sometimes they just look weird and can't actually do anything supernatural. They're just like shiny or something. And this is kind of like that. Like you're right. You could absolutely unpack exactly how the global werewolf ecology works and why there are like Europe's just got werewolves, but Australia's got were-marsupials. And presumably if you, I don't know, expanded the franchise to South America, you'd get like
were-jaguars.
Were-jaguars. You could go to Madagascar and get like the, you know, the weird, unique primates that only exist there and nowhere else. And they have like were-lemurs and tarsiers and stuff. But no, it doesn't do it. It's just this one very odd artifact.
Yeah, and I do think one of the reasons I think I've been thinking so much about this film since I saw it, and it's been a couple months, and I've just been really turning it around in my head, is there is a version of the, like, I think that this is a film that you could hand off to a different creative team, ideally like an indigenous creative team, and see what they do with it. And I think that there's a lot here that, you know, again, the sort of like the identification of indigenous people with a creature that was rendered extinct by settler colonialists, who did not want to share the land with a predator in much the same way, which may or may not have even, I mean, I think ecologically now it's pretty clear it was not the sort of threat to sheep farmers that sheep farmers made it out to be. But you know, like that sort of drawing that equivalency of like, you know, the settler colonialists like made this animal extinct in much the same way that they worked pretty hard to drive off and you know, genocide like indigenous people, and drawing that connection, I think it's got there's a real charge there. There's some like real live energy there that I think you could do a lot with if you wanted to dig deeper into it or come at it from a more explicitly, a more sort of explicitly rooted in actual indigenous mythology and thought. Because the other thing about this film is, to the best of my knowledge, I'm not an expert. I'm an American who reads a lot of folklore and mythology and is very interested in it. But, you know, I'm not speaking here from a position of deep knowledge. But I don't think any of this shit in the film is particularly related to any actual indigenous thought of any kind, except in that it draws from the kind of generalized storytelling patterns of kind of the dreaming and the idea of there being the time when animals and people were much more indistinguishable than they are now. But you could perhaps do a take on this film that is more deeply rooted in the actual sort of like cosmologies of the people that it is kind of sort of trying to depict. I think that would look like a very different film, and all for the better. As it stands, it does avoid doing something which I think would have been a little weird, which is if all of the thylacines are played by indigenous actors, that also leads you to like a place of, you know, like these people, they're all kind of bestial. That's like maybe actually having them be played partially by white actors is kind of like sidestepping something that, you know, an implication that maybe perhaps needed to be sidestepped. But it's just weird no matter how you slice it.
Yeah. Honestly. Yeah. I think like part of the problem that it has as well is that it is made at a very specific point in time. You know, if you made the movie now, it would probably over-explain itself, as we've been saying, in a way that's quite unhelpful. But it could sidestep that. It is a product of – it's 1987, is that right? 1980-something or other.
Yeah. Late 80s, certainly.
And the 80s in Australia is not a time in which Indigenous issues and voices are dealt with responsibly in the media. New Zealand has its own difficult history of dealing with Indigenous people. Mm-hmm. I would say, looking across the ditch from the outside, Australia is worse at it for a variety of complicated reasons. But it is definitely much more extreme in the way that historically the state has dealt with Indigenous people, and the hangover from that in terms of the way that Indigenous people are discussed in the media there, particularly in the 1980s, mm-hmm. Meant that at the time that this movie was made, doing it in a way that we would consider responsible from a modern perspective probably couldn't have happened.
Mm-hmm. And I think it is very clear that the film has its heart in the right place too. To a degree that sort of surprised me for a film that is, again, in at least a quarter to a third of it is absolute schlock. Like is fully just like, you know, it would be wild. It'd be wild if a marsupial woman gave birth on camera, and then her Joey crawled to her pouch. Like, and they're right. That is wild. But also it does continually swing back around to being somewhat sober and somewhat like, well, you know, it is actually like quite not just like a tragedy, but I think a crime. Like what happened to the thylacine was a crime. A crime against nature, and thus by making the thylacines into people, some of whom we spend enough time with to get to know and like, even the ones who are like not great as humans. I think it really personifies the nature of what that crime was in a way that is perhaps heavy-handed and is perhaps easy to grasp in a way that lacks subtlety. But a lot of folktales are easy to grasp in a way that lacks subtlety. That is some of where they draw their mythic power from, is that a child could understand what is being said here.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's important to mention that, like, in the same way that the thylacines were eradicated in Tasmania, in particular, they made the colonial government made a specific attempt to actually eradicate the indigenous population mm-hmm. from that island in a way that was much more extreme than in the rest of Australia. And they actually tried to wipe all of them off the island completely. And that was a thing that the movie probably couldn't say, but kind of alludes to by connecting the thylacines to people in that way.
Yeah, it is barely subtext, I would say. And one way of sort of understanding how the film ends, which is something that people should be aware of when they watch this movie, is that the plot of this film ends about 10 minutes before the film does, which does not stop it from having a completely strange dreamlike tone in any way, right? Like the movie just sort of keeps going and presents this sort of like long, apparent happily ever after where the werewolves, one werewolf and a werethylacine, the werethylacines are able to sort of like, you know, having survived their brush with the government that wishes to eradicate them through the invocation of an enormous spirit thylacine, which is an incredible special effect, not a good special effect, but an incredible one. They, you know, they're able to sort of like live openly, and you know, the sort of like the young half werethylacine, who's actually just a werethylacine himself, you know, grows up, and you end up with this very strange sort of like lengthy, kind of frankly, kind of boring happily ever after that ends, as all Howling movies seem to, with a sort of like, oh no, someone's gonna like werewolf out and maybe ruin everything. But I think taking a step back and looking at this, you know, this story being a story of these outsiders, of these marginalized people who have this sort of like deep connection to the landscape, whether they're guardians of it or not, they don't need to be guardians of it. They're of it. And thus they are worthy of dignity and worthy of sort of not just acceptance, but being valued for what they are. I think the film kind of wants to be like, to give you a sense of like what that could look like and what that, it wants to give you a happy ending and say, there is a happy ending here. There can be a happy ending here. We can actually live in a world where these people can, don't have to live in a horrible little town in the middle of the outback and keep their secret. They can be a part of society and still be what they are. It being a Howling film, it then does end with like, or can they? But that feels like something that doesn't fit with the rest of the movie in a way that almost seems like I'm not saying it was a contractual obligation, but it sort of feels like narratively, it feels like a contractual obligation.
It's a direct callback to the end of the first movie. So the first movie posits that there are werewolves who live among us in secret. It also diagnoses the spiritual condition of being a werewolf as fundamentally, basically evil. There are a group of werewolves who are led by a doctor who is trying to kind of coach them to be better people and not werewolf out. But if you give in to your werewolf nature, you will become an evil creature and give in to your base passions and eat people and stuff. And it finishes with the main character who's been infected with werewolf, with lycanthropy, because it's an infection in that movie, not a bloodline in the way that it is in The Howling 3, deliberately undergoing a transformation on live TV so that she can expose the hidden world of werewolves. This movie accidentally almost makes it into like a comment on disability. Like, it introduces the element that werewolves have a hard time with flashing lights and that can cause them to freak out and undergo an involuntary transformation. And it finishes with Jerboa receiving an award for being either an actor or a director, I forget, but freaking out because of all of the camera flashes. Which, given that it's a known thing about werewolves, you would have thought that she would have taken
it. It does not like, make a lick of fucking sense, man.
But it accidentally, from a modern context, almost characterizes it as like an autistic meltdown or something. Like it's a person with sensory issues who is put in an environment that they can't cope with and has this like massive crisis because of it.
And Jerboa too has I had not made this connection precisely, but as someone who is myself autistic, Jerboa has a little bit of like a autistic quality to her in the sense of, you know, not to get too much into the stereotypes, but she's very direct. She's emotionally aware in her own way, but you know, in a way that is sometimes like kind of orthogonal to the people around her. And because she grew up on like a not very happy, like, werethylacine commune in the middle of the outback. She's, you know, she's sort of an entertaining fish out of water in the way that she sort of needs things to be explained to her, although not in a way that the film never presents her as stupid or as simple. She's just very direct. But there is certainly a quality of like, oh, you know, it's like this autistic sister found herself a nice dude. Like she found herself strangely a guy who is like extremely down to be a husband and a dad to a werethylacine and her strange little werejoey. A thing I kept expecting the film to swerve in a nastier direction with, and it simply does not. He is actually exactly as nice as he appears to be, which I honestly really liked. There's enough other weird shit going on in the film.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, just now that I think about it, like the reason that she gets hit by a car earlier in the movie is that she gets wrapped up with a movie because they immediately identify her as the perfect leading woman for a horror movie. It's, we can't get into it. We don't have time.
No.
It's, there's too much nonsense going on. But she's at the rap party, and the all of the flashing lights and music and stuff are too much for
her.
That's
right.
And she starts beginning to have, like, she can feel that the transformation's coming on, which is absolutely, like, it's shot from her point of view, and it's absolutely presented as a sensory overload experience. Like, there is too much shit going on, and too many people, and too many lights, and too much music, and she can feel herself starting to wolf out, and or thylacine out, if you like.
Yeah.
But, like, that is absolutely, wow. It's certainly an experience that I could imagine a person who has sensory issues trying to communicate on film in a similar way.
I've had, you know, I've never become a thylacine in a moment of extremis, but, you know, I've definitely had moments where I get a little wolfy if I'm just like, you know, it's like, oh, there's too much going on. I'm like, I'm a little snappish. Like, I'm a little just like, oh, this is not, I feel it, right? Like, you feel that sort of feeling of like, not literally that your like fangs are sharpening, but that just that there is something to that, I think. And what this conversation is really drawing out for me is this movie is profoundly empathetic in a way that I simply would not have expected from having seen the second Howling film, which is not at all, you know, is not interested in this sort of like inner lives of any of its characters. This movie is, I think, not always tremendously deft in how it does that, but it is. But the interest is genuine, and you can sort of feel it, I think. And that means if you can get on this film's wavelength, which is a very strange wavelength, like, I really want to emphasize this. This movie is bizarre. It is a strange film to watch. But if you can get on its wavelength, like, it kind of hits. And it hits in a way that it almost wouldn't if it were a better or more adeptly made film. But I feel like most of the blows it's trying to land do actually land.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. And a thing that it's a very superficial detail, but it is a thing that I want to mention because it's not a thing that I've ever seen. I don't feel like I've ever seen replicated is that in addition to everything that we've said, this is one of the sweatiest films that you will see. There
oh
are
my God, yeah.
so many people just glistening after Jerboa and
dripping.
I forget what the young guy's name is.
It doesn't matter. It's completely forgettable.
After they have their first encounter, they're lying in bed together. They appear to have just been like waxed and then misted, like they are beaded with liquids. It is, I mean, they're trying to communicate that Australia is sweltering, which it is, but I have rarely seen such a commitment to making actors permanently damp.
If you chose to make a drinking game out of this film, out of somebody sweating inappropriately, an inappropriate amount for the scene, you would have to check into the hospital for liver failure, I think. There's just people are, they are glowing, they are perspiring, they are dripping. There is also, it is kind of bizarre that this film managed to walk away with a PG-13, honestly.
Yeah, that is very weird. Look, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this deeply weird movie, which I would not have thought of watching if we had not had the initial conversation on Blue Sky. It has solved a childhood mystery for both myself and my wife. And like we have been talking about, it is weirdly more than the sum of its parts in a way that you could not possibly have predicted based on the previous two movies. We are coming up to time. I like to finish off by asking two things. The first is, like, would you recommend that people check out this movie? And are there other things that you would recommend that people check out that hit similar vibes in any ways?
Absolutely, yes, I would recommend this movie. I can't promise that you will enjoy it, but I can promise you will never stop thinking about it. But also I think you'll probably enjoy it. Like there's enough going on that you'll enjoy something.
Yes.
Yeah,
and the bits that are bad are usually entertainingly bad rather than boring.
Yeah, it's a good film to watch with people, I think, because especially if you haven't seen it, like, experience it together with your friends, your families, your loved ones, your mortal enemies, perhaps. I don't know what kind of relationship you have with them. It really watches good in a crowd. And then in terms of things that are similar, I don't know. I mean, I think in some ways what I like about this film is that it's so singular, that it really hits a vibe that, I mean, honestly, the best comparison I have is actually a pretty terrible comparison, which is Robert Eggers' films, which similarly take a very, like, folklore-forward, like, stuff that doesn't really make sense except according to its own sort of, like, dreamy folktale logic. Obviously, Robert Eggers' films are not anywhere near as funny or sort of, like, whacked out or trying to have as many different tones. So it's not really, like, if you like this, I can't say that you'll like The Witch or The Norseman or Nosferatu. But if you are finding yourself looking for something that has that kind of pulled from sort of like the deep storytelling tradition feeling, like, that is where my mind goes to immediately. But if you know where to find another film like this, you can find me at Blue Sky at Osher Elbine at bluesky.social. I would love to find more stuff like this.
Yeah, Robert Eggers is a really interesting comparison. I wouldn't have thought to make it, but now that you say it, it does. Yeah, absolutely. Like, I've only seen The Witch and Nosferatu. I would love to watch.
You should watch The Norseman's good, and The Norseman, actually, maybe The Norseman is the most similar one to, not in terms of tone, but in terms of, The Norseman is just resolutely uninterested on whether or not the sort of mythological things it's presenting as happening are actually happening. They're real for the character. They're real for the titular Norseman. So they're real. So does he actually, you know, fight a Draugr in a crypt? Doesn't matter. As far as he's concerned, he had that experience. That is the vibe of that film. And there's a similar matter. You know what? That's it. There's a matter of factness, I think, to The Howling 3, which is, it does not feel the need to explain itself very much, because this is just how things work. And you're either on board or you're not. And that, to me, is very fairy tale and folklore logic. It's like, why is this raven talking to me? I don't know. Sometimes ravens talk. That's just how it works.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. I mean, the thing that I mentioned in passing earlier is Nightbreed. If people haven't seen Nightbreed, find the director's cut of Nightbreed. It is not similar in terms of really anything about setting, but it does have the strange, dreamy, dark fantasy vibe, and it does resolutely avoid explaining anything about literally anything. Instead, it just shows you a bunch of weird guys, and they do some weird stuff. And if you're on board, it's great. Also, I would recommend checking out the first Howling movie purely because it's the one that introduces the template of how they think werewolves work, which sort of persists sort of through the other Howling movies, and it's the one with the best werewolf transformations. So all of the, like,
certainly the one with the most money.
Yeah. So Howling 2 and Howling 3 both reuse some specific shots around, like, people's faces, like, pulsing and stuff, which are callbacks to transformation sequences in the first Howling movie, and really they're kind of pallid imitations. That's the one where they spent the money, and I mean, you could just look up the Howling werewolf transformations, because they go on for ages, and they're really weird and slimy and visceral, and they make some fantastic use of, like, wet puppets and practical effects, and there's lots of, like, people's bones moving under their skin in that really, like, early 80s everything's plastic sprayed with water kind of way, and it's really cool if you're interested in that kind of, like, grimy, slimy creature stuff. That is also worth checking out on its own terms. The last thing, of course, is to give you an opportunity to plug anything that you would like people to pay attention to. You already mentioned your Blue Sky, but do you have things that you make or do that people should know about?
Yeah, I'm a journalist and a book author, and actually something I can plug that might, if this sounds like something you're interested in, if you've listened to this and be like, oh, I could mess with something that's, you know, deeply rooted in the sort of like folklore and folktale tradition. I have a collection of short stories set in 1900s Appalachia that draw very directly from the sort of both the Cherokee and Scots-Irish folklore traditions, following a wandering witch as she sort of like gets into various kind of roughly Hellboyish adventures, I guess you could say. The book is called Ghost Days. You can find it on my website, osherelbein.com. There are not very many of them left. I'm very near the end of a pretty sizable print run, which feels great. So truly act now, because there may not be, I think I'm down to my last 15 or so. But it's also illustrated by the incredible artist, Tiffany Terrell, whose work you should also look up if you're at all interested in folklore. She is a master of sort of like just strange, dreamy, ethereal, but also quite creepy pencil art. So that is Ghost Days. You can find it on my website, osherelbein.com. And otherwise, I don't know. I'm around. Always love talking to people on Blue Sky.
Are there digital versions of Ghost Days as well?
There are. Yes. There are digital editions to be had on the Kindle store, on Amazon. But if you don't want to give them money, you can always give money to me directly. Those are also available on my website.
Excellent. I mentioned this because if you are a New Zealander, then you may well have access to the Libby app through your library card, which means that you can bother your library into buying copies of ebooks for you if you're clever about it. And mm-hmm. that is also worth doing. And librarians love it when you do that because it gives them an excuse to go, oh, people like this, I'll spend money on it. Thank you once again, Asher. This has been a lot of fun.
Hugh, thank you so much for having me. This is a delight. I'm so glad I got to spread the gospel of Howling Three, the marsupials.
You've been listening to Reserved Recommendations, a radio show and podcast from Manawatū Peoples Radio, Te Reo Irirangi o ngā tangata o Manawatū. The show was produced and presented by me, Hugh Dingwall, and I also composed our theme music. It's called Sack Jazz, and you can find it at wolfboy.bandcamp.com. If you enjoyed this show, why not go ahead and share it with a friend? You can find the last 10 episodes of this show at npr.nz/show/reserved on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts. If you want an episode older than that, try searching for Reserved Recommendations on YouTube. You can find me at Objective Reality on Blue Sky, or send emails to objectivereality@gmail.com. You can also follow Reserved Recommendations on Facebook or Instagram. And finally, Manawatū Peoples Radio is a non-profit community access station. If you like this or any other piece of their fine audio programming, why not fling them a dollar or two? You can go to npr.nz/donate for more information on how to do that.